welcome to... Is that how it starts?
Yes.
Dear Hank and John. Hello and welcome to Dear Hank and John.
Or as I prefer to think of it, Dear John and Hank.
It's a comedy podcast where me and my brother John answer your questions, give you dubious advice, and bring you all the week's news from both Mars and AFC Wimbledon. Today...
We're in real life.
We're together.
There is no need... for you to pretend that we are in the same room, because we are in fact in the same room right now in the great state of Florida.
It occurs to me that they might not even be pretending. They might actually think that we are in the same room.
And in some ways, maybe we are. We're just in some kind of third space that we visit on the phone.
It is a other room.
Yes.
It is a room made of electrons.
I'm fascinated by the spaces that we make up, or sort of like make physical, what was once called cyberspace,
mm-hmm.
before it became so assumed that we stopped thinking about it as space.
Do you ever have that experience where you will have a very intense interaction in a online space, and then later you will ascribe it to a physical place?
No.
That happens to me. Has happened to me several times.
Really?
Where there are like big moments that have happened in my life that happened on the internet, but I feel like they happened, and I have put them in a physical space that I've been to before. So I think of them as occurring in that space.
One of the only three times I ever vomited entirely from stress or fear or emotion was from a cyberspace interaction. Like, with my girlfriend at the time, we'd met on the internet, and she, how do we look?
We look good.
All right, good. Hank is looking at the levels right now. My girlfriend and I were sort of like in this middle of this long 6-month breaking up process, and we just had a very tough conversation, and immediately after I like... it was almost like hanging up back then, because
mm-hmm.
going offline was an action in a way mm-hmm. that it isn't now. And I just immediately went to the bathroom and threw up at our house back in Winter Park, Florida.
Well, that never has happened to me. I don't think I've ever puked from emotion.
Really?
Yeah.
I've puked from emotion a few times. I've puked from reading once.
Wow.
Yeah.
I've never puked from drinking either.
I've also puked from drinking.
I have puked for the other reasons.
Just from illness.
Illness.
Yeah.
And motion sickness.
Oh, you know, it's been a long time since I puked from motion sickness. I remember it being a very unpleasant puke, though.
It is not good. It is not a good puke, John.
All right. Should we talk about Florida, or should we move on to the poem of the
day?
Well,
yeah, I feel like we should do the how are you doing today, John?
I'm doing well. I am in the midst of a somewhat crazy few days for me.
Yes.
I was just in New York talking to Bill and Melinda Gates for the launch of their annual letter, which is fantastic. You can read it at gatesletter.com. And no, they didn't pay me to say that. Bill and Melinda Gates, not sponsors of this podcast.
They've got it. They've got the money.
They
to
could
share.
Have sponsored it. They chose not to. Believe it, they're spending their money in smarter ways. and then I'm here for about a day. And then I'm going on a trip to visit some refugee camps. For the rest of the week, which will be very interesting.
So you can actually talk about that now.
But on my way...
Oh, yeah.
I'm going to stop off in London for 7 hours and go to an AFC Wimbledon game.
Your life exhausts me.
How are you doing, Hank?
I'm good. I feel like I... just going to Florida for a vacation is just an awful lot for me. And you're like, the Florida vacation is just like sort of a 6-hour layover on your way to Tunisia or something.
So we grew up here. Hank grew up here more than I did, but we both kind of grew up here. And every time I land in Florida, like when I'm flying over Florida and then the plane lands and then I get out into the airport and everything, I always think, and this is the stupidest thought, but I have it every single time I land in Florida, there is no place on earth like Florida, more like Florida. Like, it's just
the Florida.
It's the Floridiest place in the world.
It is very Florida-y.
It's so Florida.
Sure. Well, especially the Gulf Coast.
Yeah.
Oh, everything's pastel.
Oh, my God.
And there's all kinds of kitschy sculpture gardens, and there's this, there's whimsy.
Oh, there's so much whimsy in seashells. If I had to describe the Gulf Coast in two words, it would be whimsy, comma, seashells.
Yeah, it's good. Not whimsy seashells.
No, because the seashells are very serious. All right, let's move on to a poem.
Okay.
I wanted to read you this poem last week. It was in a recent Vlogbrothers video. Have you read Octavia Butler?
Yeah.
Have you read The Parable of the Sower?
No.
You've got to read that one.
Okay.
It's the best. I've gone on to now read like 6 Octavia Butler books in the last 2 weeks. But this one was maybe my favorite. So it's from Parable of the Sower, and it's a very short poem today. The shortest of the short poems. No, not the shortest we've ever done, but near. In order to rise from its own ashes, a phoenix first must burn. It's good, right?
Mm-hmm.
Octavia Butler, man. One of America's great novelists, and one I hadn't even ever read until like 6 months ago.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah, phoenix, burn. I never know what to say after poems. Just think about it in silence, everyone, together.
I just think it's not even really a poem. It's just an observation. It's just a fact about phoenixes. You know what AFC Wimbledon's badge is?
Is it a phoenix?
It is.
That makes sense.
It makes sense because yeah. they had to burn before they could rise from their own ashes.
Absolutely, and I feel like just because it's such a nice image and it's good colors that I would maybe want to wear an AFC Wimbledon scarf if it were cool out.
Well. If that is the case, you can always go to dftba.com where AFC Wimbledon scarves are for sale, and the proceeds from those scarves go to benefit AFC Wimbledon, a football club owned by its fans and arguably the greatest fourth-tier English football club in the history of football, and maybe soon the greatest
Let's get there.
Let's go to some questions from our beloved listeners who emailed us at hankandjohn@gmail.com. Hank, can we start off with me asking a question?
Sure.
All right. This question comes from Miranda, who writes, "Dear John and Hank, it wouldn't be Dear Hank and John without some talk about death. So with the recent passing of Justice Scalia, I realize I know nothing about how the Supreme Court selection process works. Don't worry, Miranda. Congress also knows nothing about it. Why does it take so long to elect a new justice? They aren't elected. That's part of the reason. Why aren't their backups already lined up like a U.S. vice president has a vice president? That's a great question. Maybe they should have thought of that when they were making the Constitution. Why aren't there more specific guidelines in place as to who should select a replacement in an election year? Miranda, those are excellent questions, and they are all questions that I wish our founding parents, mostly fathers, had borne in mind when they were writing the United States Constitution. Here are some other things I wish they'd borne in mind. While we are discussing it, I wish they'd borne in mind that while we weren't going to be part of the United Kingdom anymore, their parliament is actually a pretty high-functioning organization. And maybe we should have adopted a parliamentary system instead of adopting the absolutely bananas congressional system that we currently have. Some of this is about the fact that the Constitution is extremely vague about the Supreme Court. It says that Supreme Court justices will be chosen by the president with the advice and consent of the Senate. That's all it says.
Is that really what it says?
Pretty much.
Wow.
Advice and consent. And the Senate this year has interpreted that to mean, over the years, that has meant different things. It used to be, before about like 1960, I think, it used to be that the president just chose the Supreme Court justices and then Congress said, as you wish.
I guess consent implies that they could say no somehow.
But they didn't actually figure out that they could say no until like 1960.
Okay.
One of the weirder things that happened in the U.S. Supreme Court is that when Franklin Delano Roosevelt was president, he wasn't pleased with what the Supreme Court was doing, and none of the Supreme Court justices were dying, so he just decided that the Supreme Court should have more justices, and he appointed a bunch of new people to the Supreme Court. It was called packing the court. And that's how he got all of the New Deal legislation through. So
that would be really fascinating if we just kept doing that, because then there would be as many Supreme Court justices as there are Congress people.
Or as many Supreme Court justices as there are Americans. We could all be on the Supreme Court.
I want to back up for a second and just bet that we're going to get a lot of feedback from our British viewers about how their parliament does not function well.
I mean, you can say that their parliament doesn't function well, but come on.
I mean, well, we're comparing it to America's Congress.
There's much I think what the idea of the parliamentary system that is effective is that the party that has the most seats in parliament is able to choose its leader, and that person becomes the prime minister, rather mm-hmm. than potentially having a president and a Congress who profoundly, intensely hate each other and see there being a great deal of political hay to be made from hating each other.
That's true. I hadn't thought about that. Yeah, and it does seem like it does not work out super well, because oftentimes you get the president from one party and then everybody pushes back and lets Congress from the other party.
Now, the alternate argument is that basically the United States was set up to be a country in which it was extremely difficult to do anything.
Yeah.
And that it has been that, and that it has often benefited from being that rather than, you know, going populist in this direction or populist in that direction. I mean, essentially, the U.S. Revolution was this extremely conservative revolution in which group of rich, white, land-owning men exchanged control of the United States with a slightly different but largely identical group of rich, white, land-owning men. I think a lot of the problems of the United States since then were sort of sealed into the cake, were sort of mm-hmm. baked in from the very beginning.
Right, but also, you know, it's gone okay.
The United States has been an incredibly successful country, and one of the reasons that our revolution was a successful revolution is because it was a reasonably conservative one versus, like, you look at the French Revolution, which was so radical that in the end it wasn't sustainable. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, they went from having one despot named Louis to one despot named Napoleon.
Right. So back to the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
The president gets to pick one. And the Congress gets to approve it post-Nixon.
They get to advise and consent. although in this case, they are refusing to advise.
And also refusing to consent.
And they are preemptively refusing to consent. I think the proper response to this, to be honest, what I would love to have happen is I would love to have President Obama nominate a moderate
mm-hmm.
moderate justice.
Yes.
And then have Congress approve it. That is not going to happen for a variety of reasons. Congress is able to cite precedent for what they're doing. The president is able to cite precedent for why this is crazy. The truth is that we should have prepared an answer to this problem at some point in the last 230 years. Mm-hmm. And we really haven't. Now, I think everybody brings their own bias to this. I think I would like to think that even if the president were someone with whom I disagreed politically, that, you know, with 330 days left in office, that president should be allowed to appoint a Supreme Court justice. And I think I would think that regardless of my own political opinions. But mm-hmm. it's hard to know because you can't see past your own biases.
Yep. Well, fascinating. Here's American history. The Constitution is not perfect, and...
Nor, in fact, is it very clear a lot of the time.
Yeah. There are also a lot of things that we're glad we've changed. I've got another question, and everybody's glad we changed, about the Constitution. It's very weird to me when people think that the Constitution is some kind of, like the Founding Fathers were gods of some sort, and they've passed down this document that is perfect in every way. Anyway, I have another question, John, and probably it's time to move on, since that was a pretty long one, and as usual, packed with comedy. This question is from Lane, who says, "Dear Hank and John, I need help with hugs.
Mm.
As I've gotten older, I've started to hug more people outside of my family, and I can't say that I'm very good at it.
Yep.
I love a good hug, but I don't always know how to go about giving one.
Yep.
My question is this. When you go to hug someone else, do your arms go above or under the person's arms? Or does it go over one shoulder and under the other arm? Does it change with different genders in different situations? I have no idea."
Well, Hank is much more of a hugger than I am. In fact,
I have lots of opinions on this.
Yeah, and you'll recall that one time the President of the United States attempted to shake Hank's hand. And Hank said, "No, sir, we are going to hug."
Yeah. Well, he just hugged two other people.
But he extended his hand to you and you were like, "I'm coming in, Mr. President."
Well, I figured, I thought that people would say the president is a sexist if he hugged two women and then shook the hand of a man.
I'm inclined to agree. I thought you made the right call, but for sure.
Yeah, and he's very fit, by the way. There is no wrong way to hug, but it is like a handshake in that you kind of can tell things about people by their hugs. And I think that in general, a hug should be firm and not uncomfortable. And where the arms end up going is almost entirely up to circumstance. And that often has to do with height. If there's a great height differential,
yeah,
then you're going to go around the middle and they're going to go over the top.
Mm-hmm.
And that happens. And this doesn't happen to me very often because I'm fairly tall, but I have a friend who's like 6'8". And
yeah,
when I hug him, I don't try to get my hands up over one of his shoulders.
Oh, I do. When I hug my best friend is 6'7", and when I hug him, I go one hand over the shoulder.
Even as dumb as it looks, you can't even get it up there.
It's not just that it looks dumb. I feel like I'm like at a middle school dance, which was the last time that like my peers were so much taller than I was.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
And so the boys who were always shorter than the girls back then were supposed to be
right.
We were supposed to have our arms on their shoulders, and they're supposed to have their hands on our waists, and it just looked ludicrous.
Yeah.
And I feel like that every time I hug Chris, I think to myself, I'm a middle school boy at a dance again.
Yeah, so and I will find myself going up on tiptoes when I'm hugging Adam and trying to get one hand over his shoulder. But and I do feel a little bit odd, I will say, now that I'm thinking about it, when I give him a hug, because I feel kind of like a little girl and I'm just like cuddling into his chest. But I think that it's mostly down to height. Where your arms end up. If you're roughly the same height, you do one over, and then like, and you sort of like, you know, you the whole process of giving a hug, you have this wind up where you pull your arms out while you're still a fair distance away.
Yeah.
And that's the time when you're like using your weird monkey brain to figure out where my arms are going to end up.
Yep.
And if you do that dance and your hands keep matching each other, and then you gotta like, you just eventually you will get close enough. And there will be enough of a difference that you'll end up in a hug, and it will be okay.
Yeah, you know, Lane, what I would say is that I always let the other person, based on the way that they hold out their hands for the hug, I let the other person dictate, and maybe this means that I'm too passive or I'm never going to be successful in business or something, but I let the other person dictate the terms of the hug.
Mm.
And then if I find that they are like me, and not a hug term dictator, what I do in that situation is I just go right arm up, left arm down.
Right.
Just as
that's sort of the natural.
That's my, in an emergency, this person also doesn't lead the hug. I'm going to go right arm up, left arm down. So that would be my recommendation.
What do you think about body contact in a hug?
I'm not crazy about body contact in a hug. I think hugs are mostly for arms and collarbones.
I deeply disagree.
I feel like
your toes should touch, your knees should touch, your hips should touch, your chest should touch, all the way down.
I like to if I'm hugging my wife, but like I or my kids or something, but no, I like to minimize
touching.
Yeah.
Just bodily contact.
I do just jetting. Can we move on to a question about Mars?
Yeah, sure.
I thought I could get you off the topic of hugs by bringing up Mars. All right, Hank, this question's from Netta, who asks, "Dear John and Hank, a few podcasts ago, Hank said Martian winter, and that got me thinking. Does all of Mars have winter at the same time, or is it like Earth, where the northern and southern hemispheres have it at different times? Does Mars have hemispheres or an equator? I'd love to know what the seasons are like on Mars, and if it depends on where you are. I love the podcast. It is the highlight of my week, and I think absolutely hilarious. Netta, you do not have a very good sense of humor."
Well, but we appreciate the sentiment anyways. Yeah, Mars is just like Earth. It has an axial tilt like Earth's,
mm-hmm.
and thus it has seasons like Earth. It has a winter in one hemisphere, and then while it's summer in the other hemisphere. And all planets have hemispheres. The equator is defined by the spin of the planet. So where it's the, you know, when a planet is spinning, I'm doing hand gestures now, so this is a visual thing. Look on the internet, you can see what a hemisphere is. It's halfway down. And
the sphere.
Yeah, halfway down the sphere.
It's almost like it's the hemisphere.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But there are some, like, for example, Uranus spins on its side. and so its hemispheres are left and right, not top and bottom.
You're never going to say Uranus without me laughing at you ever.
That's fine.
We need to rename that planet.
But there would be, planets that, there could be a planet that doesn't have winters like that, that would be perfectly 90 degrees with the plane of the solar system. And I don't know if there are any planets like that. There probably are.
But so
I think Mercury's like that.
Would you be better off, like, so you could do what you could do in the United States where you spend, you know, summer in mm-hmm. New York,
mm-hmm.
and then you're like, oh, it's starting to get cold. I'm going to go to Sydney, Australia, yeah. and enjoy more summer.
Yeah, you could totally do that, except that instead of summer, it would just be a little bit less frigid. you might get up to like, you might get up, I mean, in addition to never being able to go outside because there's no air,
mm-hmm.
You're never going to get much up. You're not going to give above freezing. I don't think ever on the surface of Mars.
Really?
No.
That sounds miserable.
Well, I live in Montana where it doesn't get above freezing for quite a honk of the year.
But
it does have air though.
I just think air is such an important part of what makes Earth enjoyable.
It is a big part of what makes Earth enjoyable. Do you want to know another part of what makes Earth enjoyable?
I do.
The question is from Gavin, who asks, "Dear Hank and John, cows eat grass,
yep.
so why don't people? It's cheap and easy to grow, so shouldn't everyone just eat grass?
No.
Grass, a thing that makes Earth great."
No, they shouldn't eat grass, and I'll tell you why. So humans need certain things, protein, fiber,
all things vitamins. In grass. Also in grass.
It's a calorie inefficient food versus like our agriculture staples like rice, potatoes.
Yes.
It is. It does not have as much energy in it.
No.
Okay. Alternately, there is a reason.
There is a reason.
What is the reason?
Well, first, we're not cows.
Well, I understand that we're not cows, but what is the reason if it is energy intensive and as digestible by
it's
the...
It's not as digestible. So that's that's the thing. You have just as much energy in grass, which is why you can burn grass and there will like dry grass and there will be energy released. Basically, what's happening in our bodies is just a slow burn of all the things that we eat. But there are certain things that our bodies are not metabolically set up to digest. And cellulose is one of those things, whereas in a cow's body, they can convert that cellulose, which is just made up of sugars, but sugars bonded together in a particular way. They can break that cellulose down into those sugars and then use those sugars the way that we would use sugar as fuel. We cannot do that, and we cannot do that because we don't have the same digestive system as a cow, and also because cows actually, I'm pretty sure, don't break down cellulose themselves. They do it with bacteria in their guts, and that's why they have like a bunch of different chambers, because they have this whole fermentation thing happening with a bunch of different bacterial colonies that are turning that cellulose into fuel for a cow.
So each of a cow's four different stomachs is colonized by different bacteria?
I bet it is.
Now,
that is not a thing that I know for sure, but it seems very likely to me.
Follow-up question. What percentage of a cow is actually bacteria?
I would guess that the number of cells
yeah.
of bacteria, there are more bacteria cells than cow cells in a cow.
Really?
I would just, yeah, certainly. By weight... Again, by weight, it's going to be almost entirely cow, but by number of cells, because bacteria cells are much smaller than cow cells.
But I don't think of myself. I don't think of myself when I think of what constitutes me.
Mm-hmm.
I do not think of the number of pounds that the cells I think of as me weigh.
Mm-hmm.
I think of this number of cells that are me, and that's closer, I think, to what I am than a number on a scale that could fluctuate wildly. So the thought that I am actually, and yes, you're going to see a lot of this in my new book, the thought that I am actually only half me is distressing.
Well, here's the question. Are you even half you? What cells count as being you?
That's a great question, right? Because if you cut off your pinky finger, you're still you, even though you've lost this part of you.
Uh-huh. It's mostly brain stuff.
It isn't entirely brain stuff, because I would argue
endocrine system stuff as well.
If you had a traumatic brain injury right now, like, your personality would be different. You would be different in important and central ways, but I would still think of you as you.
Right.
And you would still be you.
Right.
It's just like fiendishly complicated. Mm-hmm. That's all I can say about it.
Yes, absolutely.
I do sometimes
feel like I just have all of these like sort of meat parts to the me that are necessary to like hold on to stuff and move around.
Well, yeah, but I will
make
remind
weird
you
noises with my mouth.
I will remind you that your brain is also made of meat. Okay, yeah. Here's a question from Joanna, who asks, "Dear John and Hank, my name is Joanna, I'm from Berlin, and I'm not a native English speaker and only 13 years old, so I apologize in advance for any grammatical mistakes that I'm going to make." You made none in that sentence. "Here's my question, colon, that's appropriate. I've been a nerd fighter for 2 to 3 years now, and as the John bobblehead first came out, I was just a little kid and didn't even know you existed. So when the John and Hank bobblehead collection came out, I was really happy and bought them. This is the best email I have ever read. I really love them, but John fell down yesterday and unfortunately his head fell off. Sorry for your headaches, John." She even put the parentheses and the period in the right place. "I don't have the money to buy another set, so do you have any idea how I could fix John? Thank you for your dubious advice and don't forget to be awesome. Best wishes." I mean, first off, never again apologize for your grammar, Joanna, in English or in German, because that was phenomenal. That is, I can only hope that 7 years from now, my son will be able to write in any language that well. Okay, so first off, how to fix the head falling off of a bobblehead problem. Hank, we've talked about some big problems in this podcast. whether you are you, whether there should be a Supreme Court justice over the next 330 days or whether we should just leave that seat empty inexplicably for an entire freaking year. Sorry, that revealed some bias. We've talked about Martian hemispheres. We've never talked about anything as important as how to reattach a bobblehead.
All of that preamble makes me feel like you just have no idea, do you?
I do know.
Oh, okay. What's your thought?
Okay, so what you gotta do, Joanna, is you gotta glue the very top of my neck.
Mm-hmm.
You've gotta put super glue on the top, not on the sides, on the top of the neck, because that's how they do it in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
And then you put the head very carefully back onto the neck. And you should be able to retain a percentage, at least, of the bobble.
Right. I would say close, but I'm going to suggest instead of super glue, which has no flex, it dries extremely strong but hard, I would say something like rubber cement or caulk.
Okay.
So that you can get something that will be happy moving around a lot.
Yeah. Alternately, just get a new bobblehead set at dftba.com.
I don't suggest that. Definitely repair rather than replace when possible.
Today's podcast is brought to you by John and Hank Bobbleheads, available now at dftba.com for the low, low price of just $35. Might be 40.
We're not sure. Something around there. Today's podcast is also brought to you by Franklin Delano Roosevelt's Supreme Court Justice Stacking. Franklin Delano Roosevelt's Supreme Court Justice Stacking, responsible for the New Deal and possibly all of current American prosperity.
That's a bold, bold statement.
Dubious.
Very dubious. I mean, some American prosperity, some percentage of American prosperity might be able to be traced back to that. It's one of those things where if it had gone wrong, we would remember it
as
this power grab by the first president to be elected 4 times. He was essentially president for life.
Yeah.
It was kind of a power grab. Yeah. And today's podcast is also brought to you by Martian Summer. Summer on Mars. Still incredibly cold.
And finally, this podcast is brought to you by cellulose.
Mm.
That component of grass that's made of sweet and tasty, wonderful sugar. but is somehow yet still inaccessible to us because we are not sufficiently made of bacteria. I got another question. This one is from Aylin, who asks, Dear Hank and John, I'm a listener from the French-speaking part of Belgium. Like most of my friends, though, I consume a lot more English-speaking media, be it books, TV shows, movies, YouTube videos, etc., than French-speaking ones. From my point of view here in Europe, it seems that especially in the internet era, culture from the English-speaking world, mostly the USA, automatically has a wider reach and is seen as cooler, more relevant, or simply better. This is making it more difficult for non-English-speaking creators to compete and reach an audience. I'm worried about what this means for diversity. While I love the American and other English-speaking media I consume, I still want to hear about other cultures, including my own. This is a great point. And I forget about it, because obviously we do have a big, you know, you and I have a big audience overseas, especially in Europe, in places where they don't speak English as a first language, but a lot of people speak English nonetheless.
Yeah.
And I feel like the number of people in Europe speaking English just continues to rise.
Yeah, but I think it's a big problem for internet culture in general because the internet feels so big and it feels so inclusive, a lot of times we forget that the vast majority of people can't participate in online discourse, at least in the internet's lingua franca, which is currently English.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, when we talk about, you know, internet discourse, we're excluding people who don't speak English, at least when we're talking about the kind of internet discourse that I engage in. I'm excluding people who don't speak English. I'm excluding people who don't have regular access to the same internet tools that I use, which most of which are dependent upon broadband. And so you end up excluding most people.
Yeah.
As you feel like you're being inclusive, you feel like you're listening to voices that are, you know, systemically silenced, but in fact, like, you're participating in a tool that is furthering the systemic silence of mm-hmm. many voices, and in many cases, the most vulnerable voices, not the French-speaking part of Belgium. I'm thinking, you know, more of, you know, places where poor countries, communities where people don't have access to those tools. I think the first thing that I'm in favor of is more content in more languages.
Mm-hmm.
I spoke to, when I was in Davos, Switzerland, I spoke to a lot of internet entrepreneurs in sub-Saharan Africa, and the number one thing that they said was that, yes, we need internet connectivity. We also need content.
We need something to connect to.
We don't have a ton of content.
Yeah.
And we don't have a ton of high-quality content.
I have a friend who has gone over to several places in the developing world we actually, Nerdfighter community, a long time ago, worked together to get some equipment for her to bring over there so that they could, so that she could teach people how to make content.
Mm-hmm.
And that was sort of focused on photojournalism at first, but then also documentary film and documentary film in sort of internet style, which becomes just, you know, another kind of YouTube video.
Mm-hmm.
And it was amazing to me, both what she was able to do in terms of teaching people who then taught other people, and also how inexpensive it was for her to go do that. I mean, obviously, there's more than the dollar cost. Like, also, it's just a difficult and time-consuming thing to do, to take, a piece of your, you know, your career away to go and spend this time doing something that's obviously not going to make you a bunch of money. But it was fascinating to see. I really am excited about hoping that more of that gets done and that, you know, there are a lot of people who have more experience creating for the internet, and hopefully those people will share those tools with the rest of the world. Now, it was really interesting to me in this question, something I hadn't even thought about, is that Aylin says it's cooler to watch English stuff.
Right.
Which is really interesting to me, how that might get tied up. But I have noticed, as I've been trying to watch the YouTube communities of other countries, that a lot of places in Europe don't have that many native YouTube, interesting YouTube things happening. There are some, but not tons.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, partially because European culture and American culture are different, but much more similar than other cultures are across the world.
Yeah.
And so there's probably a lot of connection that's pretty easy. And then there's also, you already see that this stuff is popular. People are liking this. They have a ton of subscribers, whether it's Dan and Phil or PewDiePie. And you've, of course, it's, the easiest path is to go with the thing that's already popular.
There's also a culture built around those creators as well, you know, like there's fan art that you can have access to, like, and that makes
you
the
feel
world
like
more,
you're a part of the thing.
Yeah, it makes the whole world more enjoyable. It makes the fan community more enjoyable if you don't have to like build that stuff from scratch.
Yeah, I think there might be something special about watching somebody who's a little bit different from you, in the same way that people like watching PewDiePie, because like you know, he's a really talented, funny guy who also has, you know, that extra spice of not being American.
Right. This is a big issue in my other life in publishing, because in the U.S., very, very little is published in translation, and even less is read in translation. I mean, Americans are just woeful at reading books translated from other languages.
Interesting.
Except for The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo.
We're good at that one.
Yeah, we do... In general, we actually do Scandinavian mystery novelists fairly well.
Yeah.
But everything else we're really bad
at. We also converted the Harry Potter novels into American English.
That's true. We took the U out of color.
and made it Sorcerer's Stone just to confuse everyone in the whole world.
And I hear a lot from my readers in Europe that they want to read the books in English, that they like reading them in English because they want to read them the way that I intended them to be read. But so my counter argument to that is that if you don't think in English, you kind of can't read it in the way that I intended it to be read. And in fact, like in some ways, that idea, the way I intended it to be read, is to me at least a flawed idea. Like I don't think that I wasn't thinking of it being read in an intended or an unintended way exactly when I was writing it. And people always talk about how translation makes books worse. I would argue that lots of times translation makes books better too. Like it's just as possible that a translator can improve a novel as make one worse. And I see that in my career. Like I see there are places where my translators are so good that my books are compared to books that are much, much better than mine. like in Germany especially, you know, a lot of times Sophie Zeitz is my translator there and she's a brilliant translator and one, you know, and so my books there are compared to Philip Roth and Jonathan Franzen and you know, Toni Morrison and stuff. And I'm just like,
What did you do?
Yeah, clearly, like, that's not me, you know? Like, clearly, like, Sophie is doing something to my novels that's making them very, very good. And so I think, I guess what I would encourage you to do is to find content in your language and celebrate it.
Right. You know, and interestingly, Canada actually has rules with national broadcasting that you have to include a certain amount of Canadian content. And that's not something that you can do with the internet. You can't force a certain amount of people to watch a certain amount of content from inside the country.
Right.
And the problem you run into is all of these European single language markets, non-English markets, are going to be definitionally smaller than the English language market, which is huge because of America. And also because lots of people who don't speak English as a first language do speak English.
Yeah.
And so if you have a smaller market, it's harder to make money, and then it's harder to make a living, and it's harder to, you know, like, to increase your production values. And so a lot of what, you know, it's just a much more difficult path for creators. And kind of what we need is people to like content specifically because it's less popular. And whenever somebody like is sort of gives that sentiment a hard time for being like hipstery, I'm like, well, how else is anything new ever going to get discovered? Because you have to like something that's different and new, and there's something wonderful and freeing creatively about not having a huge audience that allows for interesting things to happen creatively, that we have to have an audience, a certain percentage of people who are always looking for something that isn't the mainstream. Not just because it's, you know, not just because like it's not the mainstream, but also because more like creative, interesting creative things happen more easily outside of the mainstream.
Yeah, I totally agree. The last thing that I would say about this is, I have a friend who calls this the Lithuanian poet problem, that if you are a Lithuanian poet, your chances of winning a Nobel Prize, your chances of finding a wide audience are so infinitesimally small compared to if you're writing in English or even in German or French, that it's it almost discourages you from ever starting. Because in a very small country or a relatively small language, it can be hard, even if you find success, to make a living, because there just aren't that many potential customers for your work. And this is a kind of privilege that we almost never talk about, but it's an intensely important kind of privilege. And like one of, I would argue, like one of the most mm-hmm. important, because it's so important, and because it's so omnipresent, it's easy not to look at like air. Like it's easy to just feel like it's right. in the air, but it's not in the air. Writing in English is a massive structural advantage. And you know, being able to read in English is a massive structural advantage. And those are things that we have to be conscious of.
Mm-hmm. All right, John, this is the part of the podcast where we talk about news, I think.
The news from AFC Wimbledon.
Well, that, and also the news from Mars.
A cold, dead rock in the middle of space.
Correct.
Or maybe not dead, maybe not, but probably dead. Probably
well,
dead.
But if it were alive, John.
Yes.
That would be, to be clear,
yeah.
the biggest news ever in the history of humanity.
No.
That's not the news today, though.
Also, I would argue that it would not be the biggest news in the history of humanity.
Really?
Yes.
In the history, you think that life on that we are not alone in the universe?
Yeah.
Would not be the biggest news?
No.
What if it was? What if there was a person who was not a human?
A sentient person.
Yeah.
Like a Wookiee.
Yeah, like a Wookiee.
If Mars had Wookiees that were living in underground tunnels,
yes,
that would be the biggest news in human history.
Okay, just making sure.
If Mars once had bacteria that might have come from Earth.
Well, we'll be able to figure that out.
All right. If Mars has life separate from Earth that evolved separately from life on Earth,
right.
would it be the biggest news in human history? I'm going to say hard no, but I'm going to say it would be in the top 200 news stories in human history. But I would also argue that AFC Wimbledon's return to the Football League in 2011 was one of the top 200 news stories of all time.
I mean, that's the thing about arguing.
The printing press.
You can literally argue anything.
The agricultural revolution. The Columbian Exchange, AFC Wimbledon's victory over Luton Town in the 2011 conference playoff final the problem is there are a bunch of big stories, right?
Yeah.
So it's hard to pick which is the biggest.
All right, do your news.
No, you do yours first. I have important news.
The bad news is that I somehow, while walking up the stairs...
You lost the news from Mars?
Into the internetless area of this house. it's just Popular Mechanics asking me to submit my email address for something.
Can you just go to no thanks? Just hit the X.
Boom!
It worked! Wow.
Thank you, John.
I'm so good at navigating the internet.
You're really good at the internet. We've got a news story here.
Yeah.
NASA is investigating what's called photonic propulsion,
mm-hmm.
which could potentially send a spacecraft to Mars in as little as 3 days.
And the current technology, we'd be looking at like a year to get there.
A little less than a year. Depends on the time of year you leave.
Mm-hmm.
And depends on the route you take.
Sure.
So big problem in space travel, as we always say, is you have to haul the fuel to move the fuel to move the fuel,
right.
to move the fuel
to get to Mars.
That you need to get to Mars.
Right.
So you're mostly pushing fuel around. The nice thing about photonic propulsion is that you don't have to move the fuel around. You are shooting the fuel at the spacecraft, kind of. So imagine you've got a hose, and then at the other end of the driveway, you want to move some stuff off the driveway, some leaves. You spray the hose at the leaves, and all the leaves go woof right off your driveway, and you're like, good old clean driveway. The neighbors are going to be so envious.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like that, except instead of a hose of water, it's a hose of photons, a laser beam, that you point at a mirror, and the photons, which do not have mass, but do have energy and momentum, remarkably enough, can transfer that momentum onto a spacecraft from a centralized place where those photons are being generated by some extremely powerful laser.
Mm-hmm.
And then that laser will shoot at the reflectors on this spacecraft, which would have to be fairly light, at least to start, and move it to extremely fast speeds, with this extremely powerful laser. Now, you got to build a really powerful laser, and you're probably not going to be shooting it from the surface of Earth. There's a problem here, which is that the laser would vaporize some of the atmosphere, would have a hard time getting out of the atmosphere, so you probably want the laser to be in space. But you wouldn't have to carry this fuel because the fuel is made of photons, and photons do not have mass. But you wouldn't be carrying them with you. You'd actually be shooting the photons from a place probably in orbit around Earth or on the moon. And they've been doing research on this, and it's a system that works, that functions. They've done it in the lab, but what you have to, and NASA is currently, you know, obviously thinking, worrying, trying to figure out how this would work. But you have to build a really massive laser, and probably you would be for this initial step, you'd be sending a fairly light thing like maybe like a 200-pound or 100-kilogram spacecraft to Mars. But you could do it really fast, which would be amazing because the solar system is really big, so big that, you know, Voyager 1 only just left the solar system after being launched in 1977. So if you want to get... And also because this is a good way of transferring energy and you don't need to haul your fuel along with you, this would be a sort of the way if you wanted to send a probe to another star.
Mmm. That's exciting.
Yeah.
But not as exciting as ASC Wimbledon's heroic 1-0 victory against Carlisle United. Hank, you will remember that we were supposed to play Carlisle United a couple weeks ago.
Right.
But then
soggy pitch.
That game was won by Waterlogged Pitch. Waterlogged Pitch has had a great season in League 2. They're in second. We beat Carlisle United. And you'll remember in the game before that, we beat Barnet. And in the game before that, we beat Luton Town, the same team we beat in 2011. That means, I'm not good at math, Hank, but I believe that means that AFC Wimbledon has won 3 straight games.
Is that unusual?
It is unusual, yes.
Is it unusual for everybody in the league?
It is unusual to win 3 straight games. Here is the most exciting part of this. AFC Wimbledon are currently in 5th place in League 2 with 15 games to go.
Wow.
So...
What are the top 3 don't have to compete at all?
The top 3 automatically go to League 1.
Do they still play in the playoffs just for fun?
No, they choose not to. They take those days off.
Okay.
And then 4, 5, 6, and 7 enter into a playoff, and the winner of that playoff goes up to League 1.
Oh,
so
wow.
Only one team from 4, 5, 6, 7 goes up to League 1. But right now, AFC Wimbledon is in 5th, and crazily, they are not that far behind 3rd. So I am officially dreaming, but I'm starting to think about dreaming of automatic promotion. But this has been an amazing, amazing run that Wimbledon have been on. They've had a great season the whole season.
So some other teams have had some bad games.
We have benefited from other teams having some bad games, but also Wimbledon's just winning all of their games. And like, if you win all your games, you go up. Like, and so I'm starting... Now, here's the crazy thing, Hank. I actually looked the other day. So the 3rd tier in English football is called League One, helpfully. I actually looked at the average attendance for all the teams currently in League One. And they are all at least 3,000 more than AFC Wimbledon's stadium can contain.
All of them?
Yeah.
Every team in League
One? The lowest one is 3,000 more than AFC Wimbledon Stadium can contain. The highest one is like 20,000 more.
So you guys got to get that new stadium built.
So obviously we have to get the new stadium built, but also it makes me think that if we were to go up to League One somehow, that would be a wonderful season. But I can't imagine how it would be sustainable. But, I mean, maybe, who knows? I mean, you know, obviously no one thought that AFC Wimbledon would go from the 9th tier of amateur football and be promoted 5 times in 9 years. So who knows? Who knows? Who knows? I am starting to dream. It is incredibly fun. It's so exciting. The goal, by the way, was scored by 34-year-old Paul Robinson, a journeyman center back who was up for a free kick. I myself am only 38 years old. Meaning that seeing Paul Robinson scored that goal, I began to dream that perhaps, in addition to sponsoring AFC Wimbledon, they might have a place for me on the club.
You know what the great tragedy is, John?
Huh?
we're in this house that our parents have rented.
Yeah.
And it has an Xbox.
Yeah.
But you didn't bring FIFA.
I had no idea that they would have... It has one of the, like, ancient Xboxes from way back in, like, 2008.
It is an old Xbox.
But I could have brought at least FIFA 10 or something.
Yeah.
I could have just absolutely schooled you.
Yeah. It would have been fun.
Well...
But instead, we'll just play that bad Mario Kart ripoff over and over again.
Sonic the Hedgehog Mario Kart ripoff, that is. I don't like to criticize, because I know that a lot of the developers for Sonic the Hedgehog's racing game are big fans of Dear John and Hank. But, boy, it is not a great game. You guys, you should have worked harder on that one. Feels like you might have phoned it in. It's a pretty obvious Mario Kart ripoff.
Yeah, it seems a little bit like you took every single thing that Mario Kart has and just did that.
Yep.
But maybe with a little bit more terrible, terrifying
worse.
Colors.
Yeah, just worse in every way. My favorite thing in that game is that instead of green and red turtle shells, there are green and red boxing gloves. But they do the exact same thing, and the red one is heat-seeking, just like in Mario Kart, and the green one just shoots straight.
Yeah, and bounces, just like a shell. Yeah.
It's beautiful. So I am actually going to AFC Wimbledon's game against Oxford United this weekend, which will be in the past when this video is uploaded, but I'm incredibly excited because it's just AFC Wimbledon are suddenly, they're in fifth! So we'll see. This is a huge game against Oxford United because Oxford United is third. Oxford is sitting there in that automatic promotion spot. So if they win that game, the math, even with so many games left, like doesn't work in Wimbledon's favor.
Right.
If we win that game, I'm going to be properly dreaming.
All right. That's exciting. We've got a couple of updates from the last time we had a podcast. Many people wrote in to say that... when we said that if you were bleeding out of any orifice, you should go see a doctor, they wanted to remind us that, in fact, about half of the people have that happen regularly, and it is a healthy, normal thing to have happen. So I apologize for being so dudes.
We were blinded, as we so often are, by...
the patriarchy.
By the patriarchy. By our own experience.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
We also got a comment, speaking of places where we were blind, from social identity from Rachel, who points out that when I said in the Saved by the Bell question last week, you can't actually separate who you are from how people see you because identity is something that is hashed out in social spaces, that may be true of ego identity, but that stereotypes about how people see you, obviously that can be extremely destructive. And she says, I think it is possible and positive to be able to separate who you are from the stereotypes that other people have about you or your group. For example, all of the research about a phenomenon known as stereotype threat is basically about the benefits of separating yourself from how people see your group. So that's an important and interesting kind of correction comment.
And we also had a bunch of, we had two different people who wrote in about the phrase turn of the century.
Yes.
First, someone who is a linguist and has access to linguistic databases and was able to identify the first time turn of the century appeared in print, and it was in the 1890s to refer to the turn of the previous century from 1700 to 1800.
Wow.
And it was only used like three or four times, though, in that entire century to refer to that. So obviously just a clever turn of phrase. And then in the 1920s, it became used much more frequently.
1921, I believe. You're allowed to use it in 2021 and not until then.
Jacob has suggested that since we do not have the opportunity to do this very often, we should, in fact, be using the phrase turn of the millennium. There's no reason not to. We can. Why not do that in order to avoid confusion in this one century when we can?
Yeah, we probably won't be around for the turn of the next millennium, so we should enjoy the phrase while it is available to us. Also, we got this comment from Andrew, more of a question, but a very interesting one. Dear John and Hank, I dropped my four-sided banana in the sewer half a year ago, but fortunately managed to fish it out. It's been in my cupboard ever since, so it's several months past its expiry date. Part of it has been eaten by mold, but the rest is still intact, if a bit worse for wear. Is it safe to cut the banana up and put it in my cereal? Also, I collect water from stagnant pools around my neighborhood and use that instead of milk. Thanks, Andrew.
That sounds wonderful.
Delicious.
I bet you could have packed at least three or four more Dear Hank and John references in there. Speaking of which, oh my God, it's burning! All right, John, what did we learn today?
Well, nothing. This was not a podcast where we learned anything. We learned that there is winter on Mars.
We learned that only recently did Congress decide that the Constitution's request for their consent meant anything at all. Which I did not. I honestly did not know, and I'm fascinated to talk to you more about the Supreme Court.
I probably got the decade wrong, but it was sometime in the 20th century. There were a few things before that, but it was really only then that they got the I
want to say bug in the britches, but I'm not sure that that's actually a phrase. But I think it should be.
Sure.
They got a real bug in their britches about Supreme Court nominations.
Is that a phrase?
It sounds like it should be. I'd Google it, but the internet doesn't work up here.
What else did we learn today, Hank? We learned that 13-year-olds in Germany have better grammar than the average American.
And we learned that John is not a real hugger.
No. I mean, I like hugging, but it should be almost exclusively an arms event.
Yes, we learned that John believes that hugs should be almost exclusively involving arms and potentially, in extreme intimate circumstances, collarbones.
Yeah, I'm okay with collarbones. Thanks for listening to our podcast, which is edited by Nicholas Jenkins. Our intern is Claudia Morales. You can email us at hankandjohn@gmail.com or use the hashtag on Twitter, Facebook, wherever you hashtag Dear Hank and John.
Our theme music is from Gunnarola. And as they say in our hometown,
don't forget to be awesome.